my story, it's sad but true. It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love, then ran around with every single guy in town.
Broken Tail Dog, Josh Ricardo. I'm here once again, and I have in front of me a person I'm a huge fan of. Actually, a huge fan of not only his work, but his wife's work and what they're doing here in my community. We have some long-standing ties. I was actually in their festival, the Queens World Film Festival, back in like 2011. I'm looking at my poster right now because I have the poster up. Year one of the festival. So I have in front of me Don Cato. Say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody. This is Don Cato.
So I was lucky enough to try to, my first big film that I ever did, a short, totally indie produced, back in 2010, I made this film called Tuck Davis, and totally shot on my own dime and favors and all that stuff. Literally pulled every favor I could. It had to be shot over, let's call it 90 days, right? And for a 30-minute film, that's a long time. But it's when you're pulling, you know, Don, you know how this goes because you're in the industry. When you're pulling favors from every corner of the world of New York City, that's what happens. And now I was looking like, you know, it came out really well for what it was. You know, it was my first kind of big stab at filmmaking. And I was looking for festivals for it to be in because I just wanted to see it on a big screen. That's really all you really want. Right?
That's what you want.
That's what you're looking for. So I got it into a couple festivals. And then the last festival I got it in was the Queens World Film Festival. And all the festivals I got in were really great. I'm super appreciative. But there's something special about the Queens World Film Festival, not only because I had just moved to Astoria from the city, but also the community that was involved. So when my showing had easily 50 people in it, which was huge compared to the other showings, I met three other filmmakers that day that are still in my life now, creatively. And it was the best response from an audience that night in that festival. So from that point forward, I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. So that was your first year.
Yeah. 11.
Because I am a creative and I understand what it means to do indie stuff and to basically have to build from the bottom up. What was your background before jumping in? Like what were you doing in the industry before you even came to this? Cause 2010, I mean, you've been around since the 70s.
Oh yeah.
So what were you doing in the 70s that led you kind of on this path?
Wow. That's a great question. Well, I was trained as a landscape architect and have many degrees and was registered as a landscape architect. But film has always been something I wanted to do. So I used landscape architecture to slide into the film business. They're similar. I mean, it takes a lot of preparation, mm-hmm. a lot of work. There's a lot of pre-thinking, visions, thinking. It's all about time moving through space. And so I slid into film.
Landscape architecture is basically you're creating the outsides of structures. Is that essentially what it is?
Yeah, anything on the outside. And it deals, you're dealing with a physical environment, but you're also dealing with a social environment, mm-hmm. how people move, how they interact, because a landscape is folding and unfolding and moving. It's always changing, and we move through it like you move through a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking someone through this landscape.
So there's tons of similarities from a production standpoint, right?
Yep.
You're a part line producer because you have to put together a budget for how much it's going to cost to bring to your client.
Absolutely.
You're part a producer in the sense of you're selling this. Like, hey, this will look great outside of your... So a lot of those similarities, like you said, producing a film is very similar.
Very similar.
Yeah.
And budgets are similar, mm-hmm. et cetera. You can have small budgets. You can do a backyard.
Yeah.
Or you can do a huge corporate piece like John Deere.
Like a feature.
Like a feature. Exactly.
Yeah.
So in 1972.
So my film was like a backyard, everybody. In case you're wondering,
right.
My film was a backyard.
Right. Backyard. A lot of it handcrafted.
Exactly.
And sometimes things don't fit right. That's right.
Which is the beauty of indie filmmaking.
That's right. Because you're right. When you're bringing in these favors and things from around, mm-hmm. it takes time.
You got to make do.
Right. So ultimately, to make a many years story short, I made an awful lot of short films. I was a filmmaker for hire and mm-hmm. made a great deal of of short films for hire.
So how did that work in the late 70s? So in my opinion, the 70s is the premium time of film. You know, you have Godfather, you have Paramount's just legacy is built in the 70s, right? So movies actually had a storyline. Movies were the new novel. You know, like now TV now is like the new novel for everybody.
Yeah, TV is the new novel.
But in the 70s, film became that, right? It became critically acclaimed. It became nutritional for yourself. I mean, this was one of those things where we don't see it as much now.
No, you don't.
And it takes festivals like your festival to kind of bring people to the forefront of creativity, in my opinion. Because it's like we said, it's indie. Tribeca is still pushing movies that are huge movies. You know what I mean? Not necessarily. Guys like me aren't necessarily getting into Tribeca. Right. But when you're making these movies in the 70s and you're making these shorts, I feel like that's a creative age where shorts, like you get Warhol making movies then into the early 80s, these great...
John Waters
making these really kind of abstract, no-holds-barred films. And you found a way to become a filmmaker for hire. How has that even happened if you don't have any filmmaking background? How long did it take for people to go, hey, let me give you money to shoot this film for me?
Well, I was very fortunate. I was making short films, and somehow or other, I was in a place in Eugene, Oregon, of all places.
Oh, so you're not a native New Yorker?
Well, I was born upstate, so I'm upstate from Fredonia.
Oh, my wife went to Fredonia
State
College.
School. Yeah, right.
She was a dance major, and she went to Fredonia. Yeah,
it's a great theatrical school.
It is. Yeah,
music teaching, biology, those are its strong points.
Mm-hmm.
So here I was in Eugene, Oregon, and I was making short films. I was going to graduate school, teaching, and I was just out there hustling. It just seemed, well, I can do this, and I was just doing it, enjoyed doing it, and found a way to. I can't remember how I would get these clients, but I made a film for a worm farmer that it grossed them $750,000 in worm sales.
Wow.
And it was a $5,000 movie. I thought, wow, I really need to get into this.
How did you learn how to make a movie? Because I feel like you and I are very similar. I didn't go to a professional filmmaking school. I mean, I'm trained now in acting and in filmmaking just because I've been now involved so much and been paid to do so. So I've learned on the go.
Yeah.
Obviously, a huge fan of film and did my homework. But you not going to film school and just going, I want to do this. And because you had an aptitude for it via your previous occupation. What was one of the things that you ran into that were troubling? For me, just to give you an example. Blocking was always an issue. Understanding light is an issue for me because it's not my background. That's a technical thing.
Right.
Vision in the head has always been my strong point. But, you know, understanding the technology behind stuff and understanding why things have to be moved. And also it took me a long time to understand how I need to make my actors match every take. You know what I mean? I remember my first movie, Tuck Davis. I remember being in the editing room and wanting to blow my brains out.
Yes,
you know, because you know the setup shot was not the same as the close up. You're like, son of a bitch, if I would have known that.
Mm-hmm.
So, what kind of stuff do you run into challenge wise being a guy learning on the go?
Well, learning it on the go. I went to the Orson Welles Film School for 2 years.
Oh my God! So you did do your homework,
and
right?
So what it was but they just hand you a camera and say, "Well, you got to go do this."
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the extent of it. But there were some very good people there that were teaching. They didn't give certificates. Your job was to just do things. So in the course of 3 years, no, 2 years, I made 4 Super 8 movies.
Okay.
And I was just totally on the go. It was all in my head.
Yeah.
There was just, and mostly, in every case, it was one take.
Yeah, that's how you do it.
That's how you do it. And you just kind of learn, well, is it moving? Is it telling an interesting story?
Yeah.
So everything was visually in my head. And my weak point was I'm just not a writer. So I don't write things down.
Yeah.
I just have this idea. Okay, we're going to do this. It's the Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. Hey, I got a barn. Let's go. Bring your trumpet.
Yeah.
And that's how it went. And then so I had modest success with these things in terms of audience response.
Sure.
And
so it's almost improvisational. I mean, I'm sure you had an outline.
Yeah, in my head.
But you never had a writer. You never wrote a script. It was like, hey, here's how we're going to do it. And you get together 4 actors or whatever.
That's right.
And shoot it.
And here's the idea. And this is what we're going to do.
Okay.
And they tended to work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's all you can hope for as a filmmaker, as you know, is it works or it doesn't work.
Exactly.
And then if it works, well, there's a chance that it might move a little mm-hmm. bit. And then, so I went from that to more abstract, because in the fine arts department at the University of Oregon, it was called motion graphics because the art department didn't like the word film.
Okay. Isn't that funny?
So
it was still nose up in the air about film.
So it was motion graphics. But it was more abstract and it was more montage. It was a montage at the time to me was just, oh, this image goes next to this image, next to that image. And I like that idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it really does, appeal to a type of personality in order kind of way. Like I'm super organized. I still allow myself to free think, but there's a nice thing about, I like putting puzzles together. So I enjoy montage.
I see by your apartment you are well organized.
The people say that. You're very meticulous. Yes, I know. The devil's in the details for me.
Yeah, and that's where it is.
Uh-huh.
So I went from that, and then I discovered I was picking up these clients, and Eugene is a mill town and a university town. So you've got the blue collar and technology, however, mm-hmm. and then you have the university. And so I was beginning to pick up making films for mill owners who wanted a little documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's the same problems everyone has today. Well, you're just going to point the camera.
Yeah.
And so why should we pay for that?
So you're saying, so businesses, you were going to them and saying, hey, you should utilize me because I can put a different spin on your product.
Exactly.
People can see it.
That's right.
It's visual.
That's right. And then I got to be known, and I was, you know, I was always involved in the environment.
How'd you figure that out though? I mean, how did you know that it would work?
I didn't.
Cause you have to have some interest in the subject, right?
Yeah.
So what was the first, do you remember the first company you went to and why you were drawn to it? Do you remember that at all?
Well, one of the first lumber companies I worked for was I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, I can't remember how we met. It's been such a long time ago, mm-hmm. but he, at the time in the mid 70s, 76, 77-ish, was the first computer and laser controlled mill. And so he was able to actually get every piece of possible timber out of any tree.
Wow.
I mean, that means advanced technology. Mm-hmm. And he could move lumber through his mill faster than anybody else. And he was driving up the cost of timber sales. And he was hauling in timber from Montana to process. And so he was ripping money, and just driving all of the other mill owners crazy. But he saw technology.
Yeah.
So I made, he wanted to make a little documentary about my mill. I mean, this is Miles, what was his name? Nils Holt.
See, I find this fascinating, but I'm kind of a nerd like that, where I really love the intricacies of things.
Me too.
And how you can make something really effective by just tweaking and all that stuff. But the layman isn't really turned on by, you know, that kind of stuff. But an artist can make things that are so benign and kind of just sterile, very interesting with the way they're shot. So when you went into that mill and you saw his setup, what were one of the things as a filmmaker that you're like, I can do this and I can show this? Right. What were some of those things?
Well, I just immediately got totally fascinated by the process.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this. He takes a picture, essentially a picture with a laser picture of the butt end of a...
This is in the 70s.
Yeah.
Wow.
A butt end of a piece of timber, cut mm-hmm. raw timber. And you look at that and it knows instantly how it's going to mill this thing down to 2x4s and whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, God, this is fascinating. And then how you can just see the laser light and you can see all these wires. And you don't see so many humans
mm-hmm.
as the other mills.
Yeah.
And you want to know how this is all going to fit together. And that, I just found it like a huge puzzle. That's exactly what it was to me, to make it fascinating for him. And if I can make it fascinating for him, well, maybe I can get another job out of it.
Yeah, right? Because that's all we really have to think about in front of us is what's in front of us. I think as filmmakers and as artists, sometimes, I know myself, I've been this way, I get consumed with the big picture and where it should go, when in reality, it's really what's in front of me. And that's what it is. Like, if I can do this well and work really hard at it, it might lead to one more job.
Well, that is the whole know? Nature of filmmaking is, am I going to get another job out of this?
Yeah.
That's successful filmmaking.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where you are. Did I get another job? And I just remember, I think the break came when I had made a stop motion film that did really well in the
stop motion, like animation, like where, like, yeah, claymation, like, yeah, type
was,
you move.
It was a 9-minute piece that did very well.
That is some tedious stuff too, tedious. Right? How long did it take you to make that?
That was 8 months.
Because you got to move every piece by hand, right?
Yeah,
every small piece.
We were moving humans, but it was still one frame at a time, one move at a time. I can't remember thousands of pictures.
The editing must have been treacherous.
It was treacherous.
Oh, my God.
And the fact that cut anything out because of how much work it took, that hurt.
Right?
Even if it was two frames.
It just stung.
Because you have to play. If you're animating, as any animator knows out there, mm-hmm. every frame counts.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to take a picture you're not going to use.
Sure.
And so every frame had to be figured out in advance. That led to an opportunity with KLCC Radio. I said it right here. KLCC Radio.
KLCC Radio. We're here with Don Gator, everybody.
That's right. And I made a sculpture called Radio Man, this giant foam radio, and the RCA dog, because in mm-hmm. Eugene, Oregon, you can find anything. There was an RCA dog about that big. And I stop motioned this thing about Radio Man, and it played on television. And local
television,
as a PSA,
mm-hmm.
and that led to other kinds of things.
Yeah,
and I believe that was kind of where it started. And it was just said, "Well, I'm going to do it." And I did this in my living room, and I remember there was lights and sound, and I got an acquaintance who was a former radio broadcaster.
So we had some audio equipment to utilize.
Well, no, yes. Uh-huh. Well, I that's the other thing. I worked for a while. I was part of several rock and roll bands, and so I was intrigued by
what
sound.
What instruments you play?
I didn't. I just was part of sort of like getting them organized.
Oh, okay.
And doing their helping them with PR and those kinds of things.
So behind the scenes kind
behind
of guy.
Behind the scenes
yeah.
thing. And then I met Rob Perkins,
mm-hmm.
who was at Raspberry Recording. And I fell in love with this whole idea of sound recording. And that's where I would do all my sound work, was in this huge sound stage. But in Eugene, Oregon, you'd have to understand it was all basically a backyard.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, where he put up all the baffles.
And sound is just as... It's funny, your personality, we're seeing it unfold here. Because sound is super intricate as well. That's a laborious... operate. I mean, just dealing with, okay, that's too loud. Okay, that's too soft.
Right.
Oh, it has to be, the crackle has to be better. Like,
right.
that is
right.
monotonous, and you really got to focus and dial
yeah.
in to do
well,
that
sound
stuff.
Sound is 50% of your experience.
Oh, my God, yes.
We hear much more than what we see.
Mm-hmm.
We're much more aware of our hearing. So I always had this recording studio because I was this sound nut.
Yeah.
Because I know how important it was. So that's kind of, and that, so I did all my work there. I then became friends with Mason Williams, the composer,
mm-hmm.
and other people. I had the opportunity while in Eugene to either be part of hanger-on, intern, gopher on films that would come to Eugene, because a good friend of mine was the local casting, and she did TV commercials mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. And so through her, I would have an opportunity to be on the sets.
Yeah.
Like Animal House.
So you as an independent filmmaker, more of short film,
yeah.
industry film,
yeah.
you ended up kind of becoming a guy that maybe people would use, like you said, a gopher for the bigger productions that would shoot in Oregon.
Upon occasion, yes. And then one was a Stand By Me, so I had a small part in that. I was
really
in the pie eating contest.
Yeah. You're in that part. That's a great scene.
And I was supposed to have a line. The first AD had given me a line to say, and it put me down.
That's Reiner, right? He directed Stand By Me. Yeah. It's a Stephen King short, but yeah. Rob Reiner directed.
It was called The Body.
Yeah.
Was the production name.
And Animal House, I don't want to skip over that. So you also worked on the set of Animal House.
I was there. I did
Landis and the whole crew.
I did things for Catherine. She was the person who did most of the casting.
Okay.
So I whatever needed to be done.
So it was more pre-production, or were you on the set at all?
On the set, on occasion.
Oh, man,
yeah.
What a... And Landis wasn't a known guy at that point, really.
No, well, no one knew what they were, what the thing, what it, where it could go or what it could do.
Is there anything on the set that you saw that you were like, wow, this might be, was there any indication or you didn't really get that much of an eyeful?
No, you never think about that.
Yeah, right? You just,
I
gotta get this done today and that's that.
Some good friendships came out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The line producer Peter McGregor, Scott, and I became good friends.
Mm-hmm.
He went on to make all kinds of really great films.
Yeah.
Like The Fugitive.
Oh, man, yeah.
Cheech and Chong. The Jerk.
Jeez.
And a producer. And we're still friends to this day.
That's great.
But you don't know when that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Stand By Me was a much different kind of an experience, because Rob Reiner's a different kind of director.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just something special about that. It was very calm. I mean, for a movie.
Yeah, which is a lot of chaos. Yes. If you're lucky, it's controlled, but most of the time it's probably not.
So I had that experience, but at the time it was like, it was no big deal. It was just, oh, we did this and this happens, and oh, God, this was fun. I got paid to be there. And, and it happened and it passed, and that's it. It's just, it's a job.
Uh-huh.
I think I even played a cop on a film, How to Beat the High Cost of Living. And I remember walking in and several people said, hey, are you a cop? Can you help me out here? And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool.
A method.
Yeah, total method. That was fun. And Jimmy Crabe, bless his heart, who has since passed away, had said, he was a DP on that, mm-hmm. and had said the key to success was making sure you have health.
Yeah.
That's true. No health, nothing.
It's a famous line that Woody Allen always says, like, you can have all the money in the world, but try living with a sore throat for a week and see how miserable you are.
Right. So, I had these little tangential things going on, and I thought one day, I made a film for the city of Eugene called Skinner's Butte,
mm-hmm.
which was very successful.
Short?
No, yeah, half-hour doc. I had to take this huge planning document, because I was a landscape architect, mm-hmm. and translate this giant thing into a common language so that the people of Eugene could understand what the planning process was all about, why they were doing all of this.
And in this day and age, let me ask you a question since you're a documentary maker. Documentaries have become propaganda for some people. I mean, it always has been propaganda in some way, shape, or form.
Sure, everyone from Eisenstein to...
unbelievable.
Michael Moore.
Yeah, the spin on a lot of news now, as a documentary filmmaker, you can really be powerful in what you're doing, good and bad. I mean, you can really be promoting some terrible stuff or some really great stuff.
Right.
Did you notice that kind of power you had in the beginning? Where, like, you're saying that the people of your community had to use this film to gauge on whether or not they're going to do something.
Right.
If you felt a certain way, it's almost impossible for you not to let that reflect in the film.
Oh, absolutely. It's hard not to.
Yeah.
That takes a certain discipline.
So your moral compass has to point true north if you're going to do that.
Exactly.
And did you find any trouble with that?
No.
Yeah.
I didn't. Mm-hmm. I just knew. I said, because it was my job. I had to communicate this document to make it simple and understandable
mm-hmm.
to the average person. So I thought, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to aim at a high school student. Because if I can communicate to a high school student something that's important as a planning process document from the planning department, God knows, and no one wants to go to the planning department.
It just sounds like everything filled out in triplicate. I just got anxiety.
Yes, let's go to the principal's office. So I aimed at high school kids and wanted to make this thing entertaining. And like a planning department, I couldn't give the... I kept saying, when's this due? I have to have a date. Well, what do you think works best for you?
Yeah, we all have to have a date as filmmakers. Huh? Like,
that's right. And I kept saying, well, when's this thing due? Because I'm going on and on and on. And eventually I had to force them to pick a date.
Uh-huh.
But as you know, you got to have this in your mind,
because
that pressure makes you make decisions.
Because it's an evolution making a film from the scrappy part of it to the end. Yeah. There's probably an evolution in your mind of going, hey, I here's the end date, and I need to set up this chronological thing in my own mind, or I'm not going to be effective.
That's right.
It's one of those things that has to happen.
It has to happen. So we got this end date, and I aimed for high school kids, and it had pieces. It had animation. It had recreations mm-hmm. of historical moments, and it had all kinds of a way I codified numbers and doc and the process.
Yeah.
So I had this thing. It was 28 minutes long. And it turned out an overwhelming success. And what happened was it galvanized the public, which is what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
But it freaked out the business community.
Because you had so much influence?
Planning. It's planning. Mm. All I did was I delivered the message.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, hey, this is Don Cato. You should or shouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. I'm just, hey, this is a film I was hired to do.
Yeah.
To present to the public information about the planning process.
Yeah.
And part of it is zoning.
Yeah.
Growth. How do you deal with growth? How mm-hmm. do you manage this with infrastructure and making it simple language? Well, and I named it high school kids because I figured they could vote by the time it all came around.
Resonated, whatever. Yeah,
road,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Dust settled, yeah.
But it was a huge hit with seniors.
Really?
I hadn't planned on that. And I remember a review.
So when you're making it for high school kids, not to cut you off, but when you're making it for high school kids, is there stuff you're putting in there, music-wise, speed, elements of,
yes,
of,
all,
of just
yeah,
to make
yeah.
sure it appeals to that young?
Yeah, pick up the pace.
And what was that, you know, like now, it would be the phone for these kids. It would be apps. It would be the phone.
Right,
it would be
right.
Picture-taking. It would be happening really fast because they don't pay attention.
Right.
In the 70s, what was that for you as far as dealing with high school kids
just,
and making a film?
I used short scenes, okay. short moments,
mm-hmm.
tried to be as entertaining as I possibly could, like I animated Whistler's painting.
Okay.
With a model and a toy rocking chair and, you know, those kinds of things. Like, oh, I wouldn't expect that to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And stop motion and a number of other
So you utilize all these tools you've already been building.
Yeah.
Because you'd already done the stop motion film.
Yep.
You've already done stuff with the lumberyard.
Yeah.
So now you're putting all those elements together to yeah. create a piece. And this is, at this point, the most successful thing you've done.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was great fun. And it was screened. The World's Future Society screened it as a tribute to Margaret Mead in Chautauqua.
What's Chautauqua? Where is it?
Well, that's like 20 miles from my home in Fredonia.
Oh,
the
okay.
Chautauqua Institute.
Wow.
So for me, it was like, that was a huge thrill. I mean, it still is.
Yeah.
And the piece is still, it's a good piece. It still, mm-hmm. it kind of holds up as an entertainment piece, even if some of the ideas might be old, but they were new at the time.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal. And then it was shortly after that, one of the instructors at the University of Oregon in the landscape department had put together a tour of China. Because this was 78, 79, so this was before we had official diplomatic things, where we were still in our dating period.
Yeah.
So I was hired to go to China to make a documentary on this trip.
And this happened via the...
Yeah.
Wow.
All this other stuff.
So this is the next job.
Yeah, this was the next job.
That hope. I just want to get the next job.
Right.
And the jobs are getting bigger.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
China, that's huge. In the late 70s, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you got access and clearance and visas and the government's
good.
Opened the doors to you.
Yes, they let us do these things. And, well, we started. I said, well, this is great. I'm going to take 16 millimeter sound. It's going to be, ooh, wow, 16. And then we got word from the Chinese that, no, you can't use 16 because it's professional.
Oh.
So I went, oh, well, okay, I got a way around that. I've shot Super 8 sound back in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take Super 8 sound and I will be in great shape and a tripod and we'll be all set. And we got a message back that says, no tripods.
So you got to shoot handheld now all through. Why is this?
I have no clue. I mean, it's the Chinese.
They want it to look like shit. I mean, I'm trying to figure this out. They want it to be a failure. I'm trying to figure out why they keep taking equipment away.
Well, I never asked. I was just told can't do that.
And you just
said,
went,
okay
I'm going to figure out how to do it then.
I'll
okay.
figure out how
yeah.
to do it.
Uh-huh.
And so I had one of the people that was with me who would be the sound person. And I said, here's what you're going to do is you're always going to walk at least 8 to 10 paces ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
Point the mic in this direction and stay out of my frame. And I will work together a little bit so that you'll always be ahead of me. Because
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a verite. It's just going to be what I see.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make a point here.
So POV in a way? Or,
yeah, POV.
Okay, so you're literally just shooting images.
I'm seeing.
Moving images throughout the course of China in different locations.
And one of the things we were doing was we were going there for a planning session. So now you can see the planning, the film I made, and
yeah.
the planning session we were going to attend,
mm-hmm.
and going to a commune, and how exciting it was to see, at the time, the Chinese so excited that part of what they were growing,
yeah.
they could keep and sell for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the very beginning of capitalism.
For them.
For them.
Yeah.
And to see their faces and to see these, what, look, I mean, this incredible hope on their face.
How long were you in China for?
It seemed 2 weeks.
So you made the film and then did you have to cut it there as well?
No. It came back here.
Okay.
So I had a Super 8 film master reversal.
Uh-huh.
And it was the first piece of film that I ever edited on videotape in 79.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all thumbs, but a classmate of mine was teaching at LCC, which is Lane Community College.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had access to these at the time, advanced tape technology. Mm-hmm. So we cut this thing on tape.
Yeah.
And it too was a big success, because it was just, here it is, this is what you see.
Yeah.
There's no subtitles, because this is what you see. I'm not going to explain to you what
I'm
going to
let you understand it for yourself in whatever way you want to understand it. But this
exactly.
is it.
This is it. This was the, 30-minute version of the tape.
And the sound worked out.
And the sound
because
was...
Because having him walk 10 paces in front of you out of frame, it's picking up what's in front of you
exactly.
as if it was you hearing it.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
That was the idea. And it was very good sound. It works. I mean, there's a few wobbles here and there because...
You're
was...
handheld the whole time. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you're the one holding
the camera. Yeah.
And back then, I mean, Super 8s are small, so I guess it wasn't too awful,
no,
but
it wasn't
still.
Awful. And I was shooting 400-foot loads.
Okay.
I had 400-foot loads, and I had... Which I kept... They kept jamming. And I would shoot the smaller cassettes, the 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that was my bag was mostly full of film.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And it, but
no
it was,
clothes, no deodorant, film.
That's right. Film. And what I chose to wear was what I thought, well, I was just kind of, I don't know what they're wearing over in China, but I sort of wore these baggy tie, no belt pants and kind of bland Hawaiian shirts. So they're kind of loose fitting.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe I'll just kind of fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did, and then after day three, I think it was, I was sitting there just at a moment of rest, and I had one of the Chinese people came over and put his hand around me, around my, and he looked at me and he went, you're not making a home movie, are you? And I said, well, no.
You're only 3 days into a 2-week trip. No.
Well, I thought I had to be honest.
Yeah.
He said, you seem to have a point of view. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm just an observer. Things led to things. It all turned out wonderful because they let us go anywhere we wanted to as long as we came back.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to account for it. We have to come back and be on time for our meals
because
they don't want to prepare a meal and then someone not eat it.
Sure.
And they did grant me the opportunity to go up in the tallest building in Shanghai.
Wow.
Which up until that point, only 3 other Westerners had been up. So I could get this 360 view of Shanghai in 1979.
Wow.
So here I am at the top, and they're coming out of the elevator, and he says, you have 2 minutes.
They don't mess around in China, do they?
So I went, holy shit, 2 minutes?
You're sprinting in there.
So I have this thing. I have to figure out what the shot is. And most of it's in the final film.
Yeah.
And one of them pointed out to me as I was making a circle, and he said, well, that hotel over there is where Richard Nixon did whatever it was. And I thought, well, that's really cool.
Uh-huh.
So now I'm sure it's totally different, of course. But the film was, I didn't realize it at the time, of course. But I mean, it's like a Fred Wiseman film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just turns the camera on. He knows something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then he shoots all this hours and hours and hours of material.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up with a 3-hour and 10-minute movie.
Yeah. He cracks the door, let the universe in, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So when did you get to New York? And when did you start thinking, was it Katha's idea? I know you're the artistic director for the festival.
Yeah.
But I mean, the late 70s, early 80s till 2010, where it starts, 2011, that's a significant amount of time.
Right. So quickly going from China,
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, you know what I could do? I felt I had enough experience that I could probably make what I call a $100,000 college doper movie. That was the plan, including Sasquatch. And so I drew this map, and I was going to shoot from this map because I'm not a writer. Mm-hmm. I have this idea, and I can make it work.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so that led to me meeting some other people, which led to some other things, which led to an inflated, from a $125,000 movie, it went to an $8 million Hollywood production. And I had interest from big shots in Hollywood because of the people I'd met, including Peter McGregor Scott, mm-hmm. Including Jimmy Craig, he said he would shoot it.
Wow.
And here's a guy who's did Rocky. And so I thought...
Did he invent the handycam?
No.
Because someone on Rocky One invented the strap, that you could strap a camera to his chest so he could shoot all those running scenes. I thought maybe that was him. Sorry.
Kevin Brown.
Okay, okay.
And they used... That didn't come along until what? One of the first uses of that, wasn't it in The Shining?
I don't know.
Something.
We'll look it up. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off. Yeah. I just thought it maybe was him.
So anyway, I had to pull the plug on myself because who in their right mind is going to give an independent filmmaker $8 million in 1981?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized no one.
Yeah.
No matter what I do,
sure,
it's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to pull the plug on myself and started another film with my writing partner. And that's what led me to eventually make, and that was going to be a cheap film too,
mm-hmm.
and somehow escalated to $400,000, and then through a series of it takes so ever to lose raise the money.
Yeah,
it took me from 82 to 86, and through a series of connections to come up with a budget of $3 million, and we raised 2.4.
Wow.
And that's where I met Katha, because my casting director, Catherine, who got me these jobs, mm-hmm. had said, there's a person who's perfect for your movie.
As an actor.
As an actor,
mm-hmm.
right. And then a friend of mine who was working for me had said, hey, you know, I saw this play at the University of Oregon, and there's this girl that was in it, and she was really good. So these two people had picked the same person.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a destiny.
It's in weird. A way.
Well, so you're not a writer, so your writing partner's writing the dialogue then?
Yeah.
You're telling your partner, yes, the ideas, the structure, and then they're trying to fill in the blanks.
Exactly. And so, and he was an AFI person from Oregon, and he was going to the AFI. And so through him and this project...
American Film Institute, for those of you at
exactly,
home.
Exactly, right. And through him, I learned how to write. That's where it came from.
Yeah.
Is doing it.
Is being there with him all the time.
Every day,
yeah.
literally, and sometimes it was... horrific, mm-hmm. Arguments,
but healthy, of course.
Yes, of course. So, and of course, I was married and had two kids.
Yeah,
and a mortgage and all these kinds.
You
of
were
things.
Married to Kath at that time?
No.
So you already were in a previous relationship.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
And so, eventually, I made this, got the money, and we were on set for a movie called Dixie Lanes. Which was a $3 million independent film in 1986,
mm-hmm.
is when we started shooting.
When you're making an indie like that, are you trying to find distribution right off the gate? You make the film first, then you take it to somewhere to see if you can get some distribution.
The producer who I found, who became was a co-producer, and then the producer, I don't want to get into all of that.
Okay.
But that was his job.
Okay.
And we ran out of money. Of course, we never started with a lot of money, but
yeah.
It was literally, it's an independent film,
mm-hmm.
where... it was never all quite there.
$3 million in 86, though, we're looking at now with inflation. That's like a $10 million film,
yeah,
I would say, around there.
And that's what it looks like.
Okay.
It looks like a $15 to $20 million movie.
Mm-hmm.
The cinematographer, William Wages, has since won 2 ASC awards and a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Wow.
For cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
He was, oh my God, he was incredible. So anyway, there was that. And that's where I met Katha.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point in time, my own marriage was kind of falling apart.
Yeah.
Because I'm in the film business.
Yeah, I know. I just got married. And you were having two kids trying to put together this money.
Yeah.
It's giving me agita right now just thinking
exactly.
about it.
So I got it shot, miraculously. It was, and I was fired 4 times during the editorial section of the piece. And I never, because they, I was shooting a dark comedy.
Uh-huh.
And they were trying to make it slapstick.
So you're saying the powers that be, the people you're associated with to make this film, which is your film that you've earned money for and you've raised money for, they are removing you from the editorial process.
They did.
Which is the process that is the most important for you as a director, writer. Yes. So the part that you're putting something together, like the whole, you have these ingredients to make this pie. You shot it. It's done. And now you have to put it together and people are going, bye, we don't need you.
Yeah, and it's sad because it is... It's the difficult part. I mean, I was naive enough to believe, well, there's only one way to really cut the film to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
Okay, there are other reasons.
Showed you another way.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was behind me. And then I came here to New York, mm-hmm. and Kath was my only friend.
Really?
Because I had...
So you moved from Oregon to New York, or you upstate at this point to New York?
No, I was living in Oregon. There, yeah. So I followed the money.
Yeah.
And where the attorney was...
Was here.
Yeah, and the only person I know was Catherine, so she was a friend.
Yeah.
She was my pal.
Yeah.
And she was living in the Village, and I was living in Jackson Heights. So all of that eventually led to our having a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I got divorced. Not because of that, but...
Yeah.
And then here we were, and then we were... Kath's passion, of course, was improvisational theater.
Mm-hmm.
So we, through a person who was a person involved with the film, financed essentially 9 months to a year run off Broadway at the Producers Club with her company. And then that led to... Then I got... my two girls came to live with us. So that's unheard of. Mm-hmm. The dad getting...
that is unheard of. Yeah, that's very rare.
So we put them through school, got them into college. In 1998, Kathy said, okay, we're going to make a movie. So we went to Fringe
Festival. 12 years later.
Yeah, so we were at the Fringe Festival in New York.
So thank you, listeners, for sending me the emails about me being in Scotland for a month. And he's talking about the festival. The one I was in was the original, and they have Fringe all over the world. And this now it's here. Coming back to play. Now it's here in New York.
And I think it was the first Fringe Festival. Katha had a kid's piece in the festival from Henry Street.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of ours had a play.
This is live performing, everybody. Live this is not film.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had said, let's make a movie. And I was just thinking about, what am I going to do? And I saw this play, and I liked it. It was a couple of women in a room trying to shoot the president. And I went, that's okay. I could do that. One room. Mm-hmm. That seems interesting. A couple characters. I can handle that. So I bought the play from the playwright with certain rights, but I could just do whatever I wanted to.
Okay.
And I figured, you know what? Who wants to shoot the president? That's like big deal. We've seen that.
Yeah.
So what? I said, we got to think of an... I had to think of an iconic thing.
Yeah.
So I came up with Santa Claus.
I love that.
So I thought, well, it fits me. It's all about myths and how do you deal with a myth.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, how do you kill a myth? So that was kind of the premise of that film. Mm-hmm. So that took, as an independent film, we started in 1998. We finished shooting in 2002. And it took us till 2006 to complete the editorial.
Yeah.
8-10 years. Isn't that the way it goes?
Yeah, I know. I mean, that unbelievable.
And then you have to make it all look like...
Two and a half decades of your life, three films.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then after that, I mean, we had really good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
It played some festivals on what we called the B circuit.
Yeah.
Take them. Somebody's got to win.
Oh, my God, yes.
And
take them.
So you go, and you show up, and you have a good time.
Yeah.
That led to... And one of the film festivals that we won was the Queen's International Film Festival. Now we get around to the film festival.
Yeah.
And so we felt...
Is that still going on in Queens?
No, because that had a terrible crash and burn explosion. And she ended up going... The person who was the running of that particular film festival was eventually arrested on all kinds of ugly things. And they made her pay restitution to people who had contracts, vendors.
Yeah.
And she was expedited.
Are you
back to France?
You're only taken in town now, huh?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we didn't have contracts.
Mm-hmm.
We were dealing with the children's portion of her event.
Mm-hmm.
And Katha has a very strong feeling that when you win something or you're part of something, you need to give back.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And so we gave back. So in the first year of our involvement with that particular film festival, we were dealing with the kids' portion, what she called her youth program. Mm-hmm. And we ran it. And that's because that was Katha's expertise and mine was filmmaking. So it was a natural fit. So we were doing that. And in that very first, they had a panel for kids with no audience. And if you know my wife,
yeah,
there has to be an audience. And God bless her.
I don't know her well, but yeah, I'm familiar.
And that's what we are. We still do that to this mm-hmm. day. It's all about building an audience for your film.
You do that very well. Obviously, at the top, that's what I mentioned right off out of the gate here.
And so this is where it comes from. I mean, her years of improv and everything else. I mean, she's always trying to build the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the very first time I met her, 1983, a friend of mine and I were having a beer in a little hippie place in Eugene. And we were mm-hmm. leaving. And there was this yellow cop banner.
Yeah.
And as I'm walking out, this young woman comes over and she's hustling me. Come to this improv show. Come to this improv show. And she followed me along that entire line, my friend and I, going, you got to come to this thing. You got to see, you know, I love some comedy and all this stuff. It was her.
Oh my God. You didn't even know it until 3 years later when you met her?
That's right. I remember that. And she was hustling it to me. I looked at it and went, okay, yeah, improv. Okay. She's still doing it, and she's an expert. Her heart is into
it. She's a hustler, man. She was supposed to be here today, but she had to do some festival stuff, so yeah. Unfortunately. But I'm glad to have you, of course. Yeah.
And so there we were giving back, and there was a panel and nobody there. She went out and found a family and one person.
Yeah.
So this young youth got the value of this entire panel, mm-hmm. these four or five people. And she said, well, you think about this. You have, for 45 minutes, you've had nothing. You have had a seminar all by yourself. Mm-hmm. That young man today, he went to film school and mm-hmm. he works in the industry.
Wow.
He's in the AD department. He's sometimes first AD, second AD. But he is working.
He's a working person in the industry.
And he loves it.
And that's his first taste.
Yeah, we hauled him in, hauled that young man and his mom and dad.
It's amazing.
Into that room and listened to these people.
Yeah, and that's 8 years ago. Are you Seven, more years ago? Because that eight, was that the, eight, the first the year of the festival? Of Queens World Film Festival?
No, that was Queens International.
So you were still involved at that's how, okay, because you're running that sec, and that's what led to starting, because that had to fold.
It folded. So so we were every year for 7, 8, 9, 9. Mm-hmm. So we were doing the youth part. We actually did the youth. We went and dealt with the after-school kids. We had these programs. We did animation. And one of our very first animators from the own charter school here in Astoria, he is now at USC. I mean, come on.
Yeah, there's all kinds of branching here, man. And that's amazing. Lives, the roots.
We've touched these lives with these youth. Because we both believe in it,
mm-hmm.
and she believes in transforming youth, and she does in fact do that. So from that, when it collapsed in 2009,
mm-hmm.
We paid money to keep the doors open at Frank Sinatra School.
Mm-hmm.
We paid the advertising for Kris Kristofferson, who hadn't been paid.
Wow!
And this is all.
09, leftover stuff from the international festival. International,
and it came crashing down. And we felt, and Kath had a very strong feeling, that it was an obligation to fill that gap. That if you could do all the things she did wrong, incorrectly, apparently fraudulent, mm-hmm. and other issues, say apparently,
mm-hmm.
What if you were transparent, think what you could accomplish.
Yeah. Like how far this could go if you were on the up and up about
totally,
it.
Totally and totally transparent.
Because but people aren't realizing, and if you live in another state, I know a lot of my listeners are all over the country, Astoria, Queens was the original Hollywood in the silent era, right? Yep. So right now, as Don and I are talking, there are two major, major, major film studios in the sense of like the shows that come out of them are pretty incredible. So you have Kaufman Astoria Studios, and in association with that, you have the Kaufman Astoria like Museum of the Moving Image. And you have Silver Cup. Now, Silver Cup is where they shot Sopranos. One of the most famous shows of all time is shot there. Nurse Jackie, Orange is the New Black, all at Kaufman Astoria. We have rich, rich roots in film here.
The very first, I teach film history also at the Digital Film Academy, trade school.
Mm-hmm.
great place. And it's a good place for filmmaking. Trade school. It is a trade. It's a craft.
Very much so.
You can learn it. Mm-hmm. If you want to be academic, there are millions of places. But to just learn it as a trade,
yeah,
we're very good. One of the very first filmmakers, Alice Blanchet, who was from France, she worked for Gaumont in France. Gaumont had a studio in Flushing, New York. And so she came here in approximately 1910, 1911.
Yeah.
And was head of that studio. She was a female in charge of a studio. Then eventually she built Gaumont, gave her the money to build a studio called Solax in Edison. So it was the largest film studio in the world.
Wow.
In the United States. Mm-hmm. Take that back. In the United States, and it was run by a woman.
Incredible.
She made over 1,000 films in her life.
Unbelievable.
For a woman.
Yeah.
So, and that was Queens. You know, and so Queens, Flushing, Gaumont, French, Edison. But Queens, you're right.
Yeah.
Kaufman was here in the 1920s. The, Marx Brothers.
A Duck Soup was shot here. A lot of great movies were shot, you know, down the street from where we're at right now.
On those stages.
So the point I'm making by that is for that festival to go tits up, for lack of a better term, and you guys stepping up and going, you know, this is something that needs to be in this community because we have a rich history.
Yes.
And he brought up the Sinatra School, which is Tony Bennett donated a lot of money for the Sinatra School to start, right? It's a school for the performing arts. I mean, it's all within, you know, 5-block radiuses. I mean, this is a part of the community. Yeah. And to not have a festival here would be a travesty. It would be, we need that.
And so, I mean, we're just two folks. With no connections.
Yeah.
That's really true.
Yeah.
And we just said we got to do this and we got to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no question that without Katha improvising our way through this, I wouldn't be talking to you today.
Yeah.
And we've kept ourselves an open book and we decided right up front, this was not a promotion piece for us.
Sure.
This festival's not about us. It's about the filmmakers because we have been there.
Yeah.
We know what it's like to make an independent film.
Mm-hmm.
Make a $3 million film that goes sideways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make another film that takes you 10 years and costs you $100,000 of your own money.
Yeah.
And you piece it together with love, care, and hopefully it works.
Yeah.
And so we understand it. And therefore, we want people to see your movies. That's our focus.
That's why
we do what we do. It's and go through this process and believing when we say it, we're a nonprofit, we mean nonprofit.
You're eating that.
We're eating it.
You guys don't understand. I mean, it's a lot of out of pocket. It's a lot of out of pocket for what people are doing.
We are so grateful to all of our sponsors.
Sure.
But every year you have to renew everything and keep going. And can you do this? Well, I can't do as much as I did.
Yeah.
So you make do. But the one thing we always do is we make sure we have the best projection equipment known to humans.
I was in a school auditorium.
Yes.
But it was really great.
Yeah.
You know, my film didn't really qualify to make it to like the big screening yet, but it was so, you know, it was so great for what I made. It was perfect for what I made.
Yeah.
It was, you know what I mean? It was awesome.
That's right. We still do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now we're in two locations. We're in Kaufman's, the Zucker room.
Yeah.
And then we are in both rooms at the Museum of the Moving Image.
Mm-hmm.
So it's three screens.
Yeah.
And the Zucker room, we retrofit with a much higher grade projector.
Yeah.
And you don't need to worry about the museum. Mm-hmm. You know it's going to
look good.
It's
unbelievable, that room. I've seen a ton of things in there. I'm there. I have a membership.
That's great, isn't it?
It's amazing. I nerd out all day.
That's right.
You know, you're actually the second person that's involved with them because Craig Schumann was here, who's the head of the Jim Henson Legacy, talking about the exhibit before it was coming out, which I haven't got to see yet. It's been a work in progress for, you know, 2 years now. And he was here about a year ago talking about it, maybe a little less. So shout out to you, Craig.
Yes.
I'm keeping Queen strong, baby, on this show.
And it's an incredible exhibit. We took our granddaughter and our daughter there.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she, you know, 6 years old.
Oh, but it's like heaven.
Oh, it was heaven.
Yeah. I can't wait to go. I'm going to be that 6-year old.
She wanted her picture taken next to Mix Piggy.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I love it. So the festival, people can go to queensworldfilmfestival.com to get all the information.
They can go to queensworldfilmfestival.com, get all the information. We are on Film Freeway and Without a Box.
Without a Box.
And put your films in there. We have kept we have specifically gone in the other direction in terms of submission fees.
Okay.
We've downgraded them. I mean, every year we try to make them lower.
It's very reasonable.
Yeah. Yes, we try to make it reasonable, and every bump up is an entire dollar.
Yeah.
So
it's very reasonable. And so the 2018 festival starts when?
Well, it starts March 14th or 15th. It's a Thursday.
Okay.
And runs to the following Sunday. So we've expanded to 10 days.
10 days.
And the idea is what we want to do is the media, our feedback is if we want our films to be reviewed, you got to have two screening times.
Okay.
That's why we've expanded it.
So people can go and get the reviews.
We can get two screenings, different times. We're trying not to do anything before 6 o'clock during the week because who's
coming?
At 4.
Yeah, not going to happen.
Noon. No, it's not going to happen.
I talked to Kath, actually. So I Dating on Set, thank you, everybody, by the way. It's now over 550,000 views on YouTube. I cannot thank everyone enough for looking at the project. Two seasons of Dating on Set. And I reached out to Kath a couple months back, and I said, you know, I have this web series that's doing really well. I would love for it to get some views here in New York. I don't know if the festival's doing that. And she goes, we've actually just this year added an element where you could submit. So I've submitted because I love the festival so much. So, I mean, they're doing it all. You guys are great. So I'm really excited for the festival this year.
And so we have opening night will be Thursday night. And then next night, Friday, or the following Tuesday will be the Indie Collect special film. Who Sandra Schulberg is one of our board members, and it was her grandfather who ran the Zucker Paramount Studios at Kaufman when it started. So he was there when he produced Wings.
So her roots are deep.
Very deep. Very deep. Yes, and her God bless her. Her uncle wrote On the Waterfront.
Oh my God! So she's just like royalty. She's just a legacy.
Yeah, and she's an amazing woman who dearly loves this festival, and we want to thank her and our other board members, Rich Bogle and Lee Montvale.
What's the final deadline for submissions? Just so
I think it's the first week in December.
Okay, so you have a little bit of time, but don't sit on your thumbs there. You know, get on it.
No, we're up. We're 240% ahead of last year in terms of submissions.
Oh my God.
That's
substantial.
It's substantial. Mm-hmm. We had a huge chunk came from Europe all at once.
Wow.
Which is great.
Yeah, it is great.
And we had to give them a deeply, well, they fought with us. They want to do it all for free. And we went, wait a minute. What do you mean free? This is a competitive film festival. Everybody, if you want to be in competition, you have to pay something.
Something.
So we can't say, oh, the one next to you didn't pay.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
No, not fair. It
doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work. You want to be in competition.
Yeah, yeah.
You want me to look at it?
Yeah.
Pay.
Yeah, you got to pay. That's the way it works.
So that's where we are. And so
I've
watched 135 films.
Wow. You really got your work cut out. It's an all year process. You really are like Santa Claus. You're working all year, man. You actually exist. You're working all year.
That's funny. I call that a real irony.
It really is.
I'm trying to figure out how to kill Santa Claus, and I am.
And you are the Santa Claus.
Wow, don't shoot me.
So
I'm your friend.
Queens Roll Film Festival, are they on Instagram and Twitter and all that? I would assume so, right? Yep. Facebook, and people can just search Queens Roll Film Festival. So make sure you guys go and follow the festival. You can do that on Instagram. Is there? Do you know what the handle is?
Well, Don? I think it's on Instagram. It's hashtag QWFF. QWFF.
What's the actual handle? At what is it? The full Queens Roll Film Festival.
It's hashtag QWFF.
Uh huh.
There's another one that's hashtag Queens World Film Fest. I think that's it. Queens World Film Fest.
Okay.
Queens World Film Festival. That's not my game.
Yeah, yeah. You're
sadly,
not the...
Sadly, Katha will... I mean, she's... hey, honey. I can't remember our hashtag.
So you can find the Queens World Film Festival. I'm actually looking at it right now. Oh, here we go. So the handle for Queens World Film Festival is that it's Queens World Film Festival. So at Queens World Film Festival, that's how you can go to their Instagram to find them. They're also on Twitter, and they have a Facebook, and the website will give you all information you need. Don, I am so happy you came in. I think we had a great time. I learned so much from you, and anytime I can nerd out with another film guy, I learned so much from you in the 58 minutes we talked. And I'm looking forward to 2018 with you guys.
It's going to be incredible. All I can say is that the film, every year the films get better.
Yeah.
Not because of the technology, but because of the storytelling.
Yes, exactly.
And people are improving their storytelling.
Thank you, man. I got to have you back. I appreciate you coming
I'd
in.
I'd love to come back.
All right. I'm run around to you. My miss the lips and a smile on a face. The touch of my hand and this girl's one embrace. So if you don't want to cry like I do, I'll keep away from a run around sewer.